Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson. Whoa, the Lead is back after a brief non-flu-related sabbatical, and we're jumping right into the mix. I know I promised you that the news was going to stop when I was gone, but it seemed to have done the opposite, with the sentencing of former Representative Rick Quinn and continued movement on nuclear-related bills in the Statehouse that could soon affect your wallet. Interested? I hope so. It is, after all, why we named this podcast The South Carolina Lead, spelled L-E-D-E, harkening back to the old-school spelling for the introductory section of a news story, intended to entice the reader to read the full article. Now, we hope you listen to all four sections of our podcast that we've exclusively curated for you from certified organic news sources. And we hope you subscribe and enjoy our weekly update, especially if you're a South Carolinian living far away, such as in the Big Apple, or transplants to the state, like my father, who turns 63 this week. Regardless, our pledge is to keep you informed. Happy birthday, Jay! Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there is a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the state newspaper reported that the South Carolina Confederate Relic Room Commission reluctantly approved a plan to display the Confederate flag that was removed from the Statehouse in 2015. Several commission members said the flag does not belong in the Confederate Relic Room because it's more of a political flag than a military flag. But the 2015 law that brought the flag down requires it to be displayed in the Confederate Relic Room, which is housed inside the State Museum here in Columbia. Commissioners felt that displaying the flag with other political flags from the Statehouse is a better option, but approved a $350,000 renovation and display plan that now needs Statehouse approval. Number two, the Greenville News reports that it will continue to be a seller's market this year, replicating a robust 2017 housing market. An annual report from the Home Builders Association showed that median sales price of a home in the greater Greenville market, which includes Greenville and Pickens counties, is now more than $200,000 and continues to rise. That's an 18% increase from December 2015, when the median home price was only $170,000. Number three, South Carolina's total export sales set a record for the eighth consecutive year, topping $32 billion in 2017. That's according to the South Carolina Department of Commerce. The state exported $32.2 billion in products, representing a 2.9% increase from 2016. Top exports, as you might have guessed, are vehicles, aircraft, and machinery. Rubber and electrical machinery were also top exports to more than 190 countries. And number four, which, speaking of exports, the state's second inland port, which is located in Dillon County, is set to open on April 1st. The inland port, like the one in Greer, relies on railways to feed it. This makes transportation greener, cuts back on truck traffic from the port in Charleston, and also tackles a truck driver shortage problem. The port sits on Interstate 95 in the northern PD County that borders North Carolina. And just like that, we've once again buried the lead this week. We have two parts to our main discussion today, one focusing on political corruption and the other on nuclear-related activity in the Statehouse. For both of these, we're joined by two great reporters that have been covering these issues inside and out. And they're both named Andy, and they both work for the Post and Courier. One is Andy Shane, the Post and Courier's Columbia Bureau Chief, and the other is Andy Brown, Post and Courier Statehouse reporter. Guys, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, man.
First, the price for political corruption is becoming clear in South Carolina. Break the public's trust, misuse campaign funds, misrepresent yourself for financial gain, etc. But don't worry, probation, a fine, and community service is likely the sentence. That was reemphasized last week when former Lexington Republican Representative Rick Quinn, who was accused of taking $4 million in unreported money from lobbyists while working on behalf of his father's political consulting firm, Richard Quinn & Associates, received a light sentence of probation, a fine, and community service. Now, Quinn took a plea in exchange for having charges dropped against his father, Richard Quinn. The elder agreed to cooperate with the ongoing Statehouse corruption investigation and testify before the state grand jury. The Quinns were seen as the biggest fish so far in the investigation, hence why the sentence irked Special Prosecutor David Pascoe, who wanted the maximum sentence of a year in prison for Rick. For more details, we turn to the elder Andy, Columbia Bureau Chief for the Post and Courier. Andy, you've been following this corruption investigation for several years. Tell us what the fallout has been so far from this sentence.
You know, so far, the main issue has been, I think, a lot of surprise on the part of everyone at the sort of around the State House that essentially David Pascoe, who's been the special prosecutor in this case now officially for going on 3 years, called Rick Quinn sort of the most corrupt politician in Columbia. He called the enterprises his father ran, the one of the state's most corrupt. And what did they get for it? They got essentially get out of jail free cards, what a lot of people feel, if that was indeed the case. You know, when it comes down to plea agreements, it's what you think you can prove in, you know, before a jury. I think, you know, one of the issues that Pascoe was going to face was that this was going to be a lot of let's put some connections together. Do you understand this is how this works? Or a lot of legalese that may go over juries' heads. We really don't know, but that's, you know, sort of the best guess at this point. The other issue is that, you know, as much as, you know, you had mentioned, of course, the Quinns were considered the big fish in all of this. Is there bigger fish?
Question.
Is there,
yeah.
is you know, there was a raid on Richard Quinn's firm almost a year ago. And there's a question of maybe is there another fish, a bigger fish that Solicitor Pascoe is going after. So, you know, it's not over, but we're not really quite sure where this is going next.
When we talk about bigger fish, I'm loving that we're talking about fish. I was in New Orleans for a week, so I got my fill of fish. But going back to this, bigger fish because what? We have so many of these clients for Richard Quinn and Associates that are potential targets possibly of what Richard Quinn will be giving testimony before the grand jury. I mean, who knows who could shake out from there? I mean, I don't want you to speculate, necessarily even name names if you don't want to, but well, I mean, there's several clients that work or had worked with RQ&A.
Well, and there are, and some of them were the biggest corporations in the state. I mean, they include SCANA, they include Blue Cross Blue Shield, they include USC, the Ports Authority, Palmetto Health, the largest health hospital network in the state. You know, politicians from, you know, Lindsey Graham to Henry McMaster to Alan Wilson, the Attorney General. So, I mean, you've got a number of clients he's had, but we don't know, again, where this is heading. We have no indication about a direction at this point, or if there is going to be any more, if there's just going to be a discussion and then maybe he doesn't take anything more before the grand jury as far as charges. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're playing a little bit of wait and see. But again, there was a lot of expectation about what was going to happen with the Quinns, and it didn't. And it's now given the Quinns fuel to sit here and say, wait a minute, you were calling us the most corrupt in Columbia, and this is what you want to basically have us plead guilty to? This doesn't really make a lot of sense. This doesn't really make us – this doesn't match the picture you're painting of us. And over the weekend, I spoke to Rick and Richard, who both are very unhappy, clearly, about how they've been treated. And again, just like what Judge Mullen said, if there was some there, take it to trial. Let's see what's going to happen. Otherwise, you know, you sort of wonder why he went with this decision. And again, David Pascoe's not showing his hand on that at the moment.
And what was the reaction like from the Quinns when you sat down with them? I mean, you said they were clearly somewhat upset about this, but at the same time, you know, guilty pleas did take place. So, I mean, there has to be a little give and take there. I mean, but are they still standing? I know Rick was really always pushing that special prosecutor, David Pascoe, who's the solicitor in Orangeburg, that it was more of a political witch hunt. I mean, do they still stand by that accusation?
They do, very much. David Pascoe did start a campaign account to run against Alan Wilson as Attorney General in 2010. Alan Wilson is a friend of the Quinns and is a client of Richard Quinn's. So they feel that this was, you know, he's a Democrat. They basically back Republicans, that this was a political witch hunt, more or less. You know, Rick said, look, I pled guilty to the one thing I should have done, which was I should have put on my economic disclosure report that a building that I co-signed a loan for, we leased to USC, which was is obviously they lobby lawmakers. You're supposed to do that if there's any of that relationship that you have with someone who might potentially lobby you. Mm-hmm. So he said, my bad. And essentially, Richard was not himself charged. His firm accepted a fine for illegal lobbying. So, again, there are some folks out there who are just saying there was a whole lot of bluster and it came out with a whimper.
You know, we had former House Majority Leader Jim Merrill, Republican from Charleston, plead guilty in the past, and former House Speaker Bobby Harrell. Both were sentenced to probation. Does this mean does South Carolina have ethics laws in place that, I mean, where you can actually do these things, use misconduct in office, but at the same time not really have too much of a repercussion? I mean, what are ethics watchers saying about this?
I think it's where the line is, and the lines are very gray. They maybe need to be a little brighter on some of these issues. Again, how can you use money? How can your campaign money? How can you you sort of bridge that gap between what you do 9 to 5 and what you do at the state house, because being in the state house is a part-time job. There's a reason why it only meets Tuesdays through Thursdays, so that on Mondays and Fridays people can continue their law practices, their insurance practices, whatever else they do for a living. So there is some talk about trying to make those, as I said, that line a lot brighter. But the Quinns were unique. You had Richard, who had both political and business clients. You had his son, who was in the legislature, who also was in a political oriented business. He did a printing and mailing business. He also was a political consultant. So to a certain degree, the Quinns are unique. And what's interesting is that, of course, the three remaining lawmakers who are still have charges against them are either Richard Quinn clients or were Richard Quinn employees. In fact, you had lawmakers who were working for Richard, which was apparently allowed, again, under the laws. So are these things that need to be addressed? It sounds like it. And again, the ethics watchers would love for that to happen, to make that line, as I said, bright and shiny. You know when you cross it, you know when you don't.
And speaking of that, I mean, is there a push for ethics reform? I mean, I know we had some stuff go through in 2016, but it was still kind of watered down, and that dealt with, you know, reporting the sources of income but not the amounts of the income, which would have really had a bigger effect if people would have known how much money they're getting from certain groups, per se.
Andy Brown's been following that a little closely.
I mean, there's been a push for a bunch of ethics reform. I think there's probably 6 or 8 bills in the House and Senate currently from last year and new introductions this year, none of which have been taken up. You have bills that would make it a requirement that lawmakers actually file their electronic receipts on their campaign accounts with the Ethics Commission. And that's interesting because currently they just file out a paper form that tells the Ethics Commission how much they've spent out of their campaign account, where that money went. This would actually be kind of like if you signed into your local bank account online, you could see up to the minute where money was going, what it was used for. And so there's a push to do that. But again, no traction there. There's other pushes to kind of clear up campaign financing with so-called dark money groups. Mm-hmm. Representative Gary Clary, a Republican, had introduced that bill last year. It hasn't gained any ground. So it's interesting to watch these things kind of fail at a time whenever there's so much focus outside of the state house on ethics.
And so we're 5 years into this investigation, wrapping up this segment about the investigation. What's next, Andy, Shane? What's left? What will happen? We're still waiting to hear what Richard Quinn's testimony before a state grand jury will lead us. What are you guys watching right now for the next dominoes?
You hit it, which is we obviously are curious to know what Richard Quinn might share on the grand jury. And, of course, grand juries are secret, so we won't know what he's saying. But we'll know, obviously, at the end of it, whether we're going to see any indictments or not, or whether David Pascoe says, we're done, except for obviously the ongoing cases involving the one current and two former lawmakers that he has standing. So I think that's what we're waiting for next. And then if there are more indictments, then we'll see where this kind of takes us. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting to see is that, of course, a lot of these companies hired lawmakers and did things. I mean, such as in the Jim Merrill case, there was some evidence that, you know, he had been hired. He was a lawmaker. He helped with their bills. So is it a situation where maybe we're going after some of these enablers, so to speak. It'll be interesting to see. But at this moment, it's a waiting game, just like it's been for the past 5 years.
From one waiting game to another, we switched to developments over the past week involving the Dominion Energy deal to buy SCANA, which is the beleaguered parent company of SCE&G, which is at the center of the VC Summer nuclear project debacle. The Senate voted unanimously last week to give utility regulators on the Public Service Commission until the end of the year to scrutinize the decision-making at VC Summer and to review Dominion's proposed $14.6 billion takeover of SCANA. Now, the House also passed a bill requiring several of those utility regulators to be replaced before the commission decides whether SCANA or its customers continue to pay for those unfinished reactors in Fairfield County. And joining me now is the Post and Courier's Andy Brown, who we'll refer to as Andy the Younger in this situation. And Andy, tell us a little bit about what's going on with SCANA and Dominion and what they really want lawmakers to be doing right now.
There is 20 different directions that lawmakers are running right now. There's two main efforts that happened last week. One was the Senate, led by Senator Shane Massey, the Senate Majority Leader out of Edgefield, pushed a proposal. It's actually not a bill. It's a resolution that would extend the clock for the Public Service Commission. It would give those utility regulators on that commission until November to hold a hearing, so they can hold a hearing after November 1st on Dominion's proposed takeover of SCANA. And they'll also be reviewing SCANA's handling of VC Summer in that same hearing. And then they will have until December 21st to issue an order, which essentially says whether SCANA can continue to collect money for VC Summer. It'll state essentially, because of that fact, whether Dominion Energy takes over SCANA. And so it's a huge multi-billion dollar case that lawmakers wanted to give those utility regulators more time to review and go over the evidence on. That passed overwhelmingly, I think, to a large degree because lawmakers still aren't sure what's going on here. They still want the Public Service Commission and the Office of Regulatory Staff, the state's utility watchdog, to conduct an audit of SCANA's finances to kind of double check to make sure that the company isn't wrong in saying that they're going to go bankrupt if lawmakers take action against them. And so that also played out last week with the Public Service Commission giving that Office of Regulatory Staff months to find an outside accounting firm that is familiar with utility accounting and to pour through SCANA's books and essentially offer up an explanation of whether or not that company would no longer be able to operate if they didn't receive $37 million a month for the nuclear reactors. Then in the House, the lawmakers already passed a bill over there that would strip away that $37 million a month as the courts and the regulators decide whether SCANA keeps the money for the VC Summer project. The Senate hasn't acted on that yet, but last week they took another step in starting the replacement process for the public service commissioners. Peter McCoy, a Republican out of Charleston who kind of led that effort, said that a story that we published back in late December kind of sped up that process. We reported that the public service commissioners took these paid conference trips from utility associations. They went to Seattle and Los Angeles and San Diego and island resorts in Florida, where they kind of rub elbows with utility executives. And they never disclosed that to the Ethics Commission. And so we reported that. And it started the conversation anew kind of with lawmakers on ethics for these utility regulators who have a huge role in really deciding the profit margins for these companies. And what we saw in our investigation was that, you know, they often associate at these conferences with the very people they're supposed to hold in check. Mm-hmm. And so lawmakers in the House passed a bill to start a replacement of the current seven commissioners. And that still has to be passed by the Senate. But I assume that it will gain some traction there in the Senate.
I want to go back to something about the PSC and that bill that went through the Senate, which would give the PSC, the Public Service Commission, which is the watchdog that looks over all utilities in the state, which would give them more time. Why is it so important that the PSC has more time? And would this affect customers if they didn't have more time to look at this deal and other issues relating to it?
So I'll put it into context. Most utility cases, you're dealing with a rate increase where you're at, you know, it's a water utility, say, and you're looking at how much they spend on pipes, installing new pipes to go to people's homes to deliver water. This case is much, much larger. You're talking about not only half of a $9 billion nuclear project in Fairfield County that collapsed that regulators are going to have to review. You're also having them review a multi-billion dollar merger proposal between Dominion and SCANA. And so one lawyer who is going to be practicing in front of the Public Service Commission in this case, kind of opposing SCANA's attempt to merge with Dominion, said he's not sure if he's ever seen a case this large anywhere in the country, utility-wise. And so,
yeah, that $9 billion is centrally related to that $14.6 billion merger. I mean, you got so many moving parts, and they were saying we want this done by July, and it's like, whoa.
You're gonna have a full review too of a decade long project. So you're gonna have documents, evidence being presented for 10 years worth of what SCANA was telling utility regulators. And maybe what they were discussing behind closed doors in their own internal documents. And so it's really going to be this scrutiny of what they knew when, how they disclosed it to regulators. And that is ultimately going to be the big decision that's going to be made, is whether or not they were upfront, truthful, and open with the state's utility regulators who were supposed to know everything about this project.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going along a more current state of play right now, Dominion CEO Tom Farrell was before senators last week, and even speaking towards this $14.6 billion proposed merger, he couldn't even give a clear answer on how his company would benefit from the nuclear surcharge, and that's the money that you're paying, roughly $27 a month if you're an SCNG customer, out of your bill for the nuclear reactors that are just still currently a hole in the ground in Fairfield County. I mean, is that an example of just how complex and how many unknowns are still left to be discovered in this case?
I mean, I will say this. I think Mr. Farrell may not have known exactly how much the company was going to profit during that hearing. It's probably hard to believe, as Senator Massey pointed out, that the company doesn't know how much money it will collect from customers for a nuclear surcharge that they plan to charge over the next two decades. They have accountants. They do the math, I'm pretty sure, on that. But in any case, it is complex, and you're talking about people's money, and you're talking about a project that up until, half a year ago, everybody kind of seemed to just shrug off,
Yeah.
Everybody thought it was going to be built. There were a few people out there, like the Sierra Club and Friends of Earth, who really had questions about how it was progressing. But the average person in South Carolina had no clue that this thing was even billions of dollars over budget already. So I expect there will be a lot of information that comes out in that PSC hearing come November that will shed even more light onto what we already know about this nuclear project.
What's Dominion doing? Are they just biding their time at this point? I mean, they're really kind of at the mercy of the state house, the legislature at this point. They really can't do too much other than rally a little bit, try and push some people in one direction or another. But it seems like the ball's in the state house's court right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's been in the lawmakers' court. It's a matter of what they do not want to happen, Dominion and SCANA, they do not want to see the Senate take up the same bill that the House passed a couple weeks ago that would temporarily strip away the nuclear surcharge, that $37 million a month that SCANA gets to collect for the reactors. The Senate hasn't even started debating that, and lobbyists are still pushing hard, telling them, senators, that this would ruin the whole thing. You're going to ruin, you're going to ruin SCANA. You're going to ruin our deal with Dominion. And so that's their focus right now. Mm-hmm. The extension, it may not be to their liking, extending the decision till December. But ultimately, what they really fear is losing that flow of cash that keeps SCANA's business running right now.
And is there anything we should be looking forward to this week in the State House?
Yeah, I think you're going to see the House possibly take up that Senate resolution to extend the clock for the utility regulators. And it'll be interesting to see, now that the Senate took their action, whether or not debate actually starts in the committee process on whether senators will remove that $37 million a month until the courts and the utility regulators can decide who pays for VC Summer in the long run. Some senators seem pretty pessimistic about that bill that the House sent over to them. But that's what we're going to be watching.
Well, a lot of great insight, a lot of good knowledge on two major issues working their way through the state here. And we have Andy Shane and Andy Brown, who joined us and gave us that great knowledge. Thanks, guys, for joining us again.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Now let's hit the old dusty campaign trail right quick to bring you up to speed on news regarding statewide political campaign activity. Well, it looks like we got another partner joining us on the campaign trail, this time one for the Republican wagon train. You may have heard his name mentioned before, but upstate businessman John Warren made it official and has jumped into the gubernatorial race. Warren, who is a real estate lender and former Marine infantry captain, joins a crowded field that now stands at 5, which includes him. Several candidates have been campaigning for almost a year now and raised millions of dollars in attempts to garner the crucial name recognition needed to win the upcoming June 12th primary. The field so far for the Republicans includes Governor Henry McMaster, Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant, former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill, and former State Health Department Director Catherine Templeton. Warren is not the only latecomer to the race, even though filing doesn't open until mid-March. Florence antitrust lawyer Marguerite Willis became the third Democrat to join the field, with Representative James Smith and businessman Phil Noble also rounding out the Democratic field. We'll continue to watch the campaign trail for you, partner, But rest assured, if anyone breaks an axle or gets an ox loose or fords a river, you'll be the first to know about it here on the Campaign Trail on the South Carolina Lead podcast. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government, named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, this, I must say, is probably one of our most interesting Did You Know's, especially if you're a CPA or just enjoy the words like revenue, capital spending, and things like one-time dollars. Listen up, because this Did You Know is for you. That's because we're talking about the state budget. And did you know that the state budget begins its journey in the House first before heading over to the Senate? Well, now you do. And you know why? Because it's baked into the Constitution of not only our country, but our state, and what's known as the Origination Clause. Here's how Article 3, Section 15 of South Carolina's Constitution reads. Bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but may be altered, amended, or rejected by the Senate. Now, I bring up this fascinating aspect of our state's constitution because starting this week, the full House Ways and Means Committee, which deals with revenue bills, will start crafting the state budget. The House will then begin to debate the second week of March, and then they'll vote on the budget and kick it over to the Senate Finance Committee, which will begin their deliberations on the bill as well. Once the Senate begins floor debate on the bill, which happens in early April, all other bills will fall behind the budget and likely won't get passed this year, since there will be less than a month left in session before it ends. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Watch my Statehouse video recaps every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, live at 7 p.m. on SCETV's Facebook, YouTube, and my Twitter at Gavin Jackson. Read the Statehouse Daybook on SCETV.org and listen to coverage on South Carolina Public Radio. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email questions, comments, story ideas, or just your gripes to scleede@scetv.org. Did you get that? And the South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our coordinating producer. Our executive producer is Tom Posey. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on February 19th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.